This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. McLean County residents are hesitant to invest in new transportation technology and have made it clear in a recent survey, maintain the current road network before expanding it.
One of the sort of big changes was looking at a much narrower land use area for future development, simply because there's an enormous amount of land available already.
Jennifer Six is the transportation planner for the McLean County Regional Planning Commission and says less sprawl means less expansion of the transportation network. She'll talk about the results of the recent survey. Find out what happens when a woman has to make a choice between putting food on the table for her family or buying feminine hygiene products. And GLT's Judy Valente previews West Side Story on stage at Bloomington Community Players. All of that, plus a GLT News update on the way. It's March 16th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The results of a McLean County transportation survey are in and show the public's willingness to invest in new technology or thinking of the transportation system as a driver for innovation is lagging. The survey will be used in part to develop the 2017 Metropolitan Transportation Plan, which projects two decades into the future. In the studio is McLean County Regional Planning Commission Transportation Planner Jennifer Six. Jennifer, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Happy to be here, Mike.
Before we move into this interview, I need to disclose that I'm the acting chair of the Connect Transit Board of Trustees and a founding member of the bicycle advocacy organization Bike Blono. We'll get to some bike and bus questions a little later. How are you interpreting this reluctance to invest in new technology, and what does the McLean County Regional Planning Commission do with this information as it develops its transportation plan?
Well, I think we have two reactions to this particular finding, one of which is that there's a longstanding and fairly widespread reluctance to spend in this community. And we've seen that in a number of ways. And we've certainly seen it with respect to the transportation system. You mentioned transit. That's certainly one example. The other thing we've decided is that in some of these questions, it represents insufficient understanding on the part of the people who took the survey, and there were lots of them. We were really pleased with that, in what we were talking about. So when we gave examples, they were kind of a little bit out there, and people weren't comfortable with that in terms of thinking ahead. So we have to do a better job, and we're thinking about how to do that in explaining what we mean, talking about what the possibilities are, getting out into the public and making everyone comfortable with the notion that things are going to change. There's no way we stop that, and we have to be ready to assimilate those changes.
Were the results in this area, gauging respondents' willingness to see investments in technology, gathered in the question about spending the fictional $100 on transportation issues?
That was part of it. It's also kind of a broader look at the results of the priorities question, which was the one where we offered four options and said, which of these, you know, do you think is the way transportation should function in our community? But primarily, it was the $100 divvied up question.
And it finished last in that, didn't it?
Yeah. It depended. If you break it out a little bit more, it kind of varies. There are some interesting differences going on there. But most of what we found was that, again, there was an unfamiliarity with what this referred to, and I think that made people sort of reluctant to deal with it. And the other problem was that...
So did you need to get more specific when it came to the phrase technology, about what kind of technology asking about?
That would probably have helped. We were trying to keep it short and sweet, so that caused some difficulties. The other thing we determined, at least I've determined, is that the nature of the question, the way it was structured, that same sort of process is what we use in planning meetings, charrettes, whatever, to try and draw people in and participate. So you hand them monopoly money and say, okay, here's how much you've got to work with. Here are the list of things that have to happen. You figure out where to spend the money. It turns out that doesn't work so well as a written question. And a lot of people were confused by how it was set up and, you know, the fact that it didn't divide evenly and things like that. So we'll find a better way to do that in the future. But in the meantime, we have to take it with a slight grain of salt just because of the lower response level on that particular question.
There's no doubt this is a very car-centric community. 85% agree it's easy to get around the community in a car. How do the results of this survey compare with past survey results as it concerns this mode of transportation?
Well, it's pretty stable. And if anything, there's a tiny little decrease in people who opt for it. But for the most part, it's not so much that people have stopped using their cars. It's more that they occasionally use some other mode. And we see that ever so slightly in the data. I think we would have to do a much more intensive and broader survey to really know for sure that that was true.
So there's a minor shift to multimodal.
Yeah, and I think part of that is the greater relationship that people understand between using bicycles and using transit and the availability of connections between the two. But I'm not seeing a huge change yet, and we have to wait and see what kind of trends develop and how well we can model them in terms of actual numbers versus a survey with a small sample.
I think it's surprising that 38% of the respondents don't think it's safe to walk to an important destination. Is that because of the prevalence of cars, or is it the built environment?
From the handful of comments we got on each of these questions, and there weren't anything like the number of comments typed in by people that there were 5 years ago.
But unfamiliarity with walking, maybe.
What's that? Yes, what a concept. I think it was a collection of those things. You did get some references to speeding cars and to the fact that the road itself was a dangerous environment to be in as a pedestrian. I think there was also some safety concern of a more of a personal security issue for people who felt that they were more vulnerable walking and, you know, not being encased in a vehicle of some kind in, you know, various situations after dark, whatever. When we looked at the data and broke it out a little bit by demographic groups, that particular question was more responded to by women responding rather than men. And when we looked at some of the other data, some of the other questions, there was the one sort of notable thing was a gender split.
And I have some questions about
that. Okay, good.
We'll get to that. As it concerns the built environment, let's talk about Veterans Parkway for a moment. Were there any comments or anything in the survey that gauged sort of what people thought of their access on this roadway or access across this roadway?
It's funny. We heard that somewhat 5 years ago. I didn't really run into that this time because I think people have kind of given up on the idea of getting across Veterans Parkway or finding it as a congenial environment or even an adaptable environment for non-motorized transit or travel. And we've had conversations for years now about some sort of trail installation in that area. And it's really difficult to figure out where you could put it and how you could get it across intersections. You know, the one example we have goes under. And you can only do that so often.
We talked about this survey back in October when the responses were still being gathered. Here's what you said about the bicycle as a mode of transportation during that interview.
They're cheap, they're practical, or they can be cheap. They are person-driven rather than requiring fuel, which is always a good thing. And we already see that they are popular. There's no reason why that would change given the trends we tend to see.
So what role do you think they'll play in a future transportation system in Bloomington Normal?
We have the beginnings of a good bicycle network. Part of it, obviously, the Constitution Trail is off-road, but we're starting to play with the idea of using street networks as bicycle facilities as well as cars. They already are. It's just we need to make sure everyone recognizes that.
That's Jennifer Six with the McLean County Regional Planning Commission from October of 2016. And she's in the studio now. Nearly a quarter of respondents had no opinion regarding bikes as transportation. What do you make of that?
I make of that that they came from the group that is in the 85% or such that primarily use cars and haven't thought, you know, they may use the trail, they may use other forms of non-motorized transportation, but they're not seeing it in the context we would like to see, which is as a fully equal method of transportation that should be considered in all of our decisions. We have to do that. The local governments have to do that. It's required so that they can get access to funding. And we have to be able to demonstrate that. But for the general public, I think it's still a work in progress in terms of making that leap into understanding that approach. We were hoping to be able to do a project on a section of Main Street, sort of looking at a specific segment and deciding how we could adapt it to make it more multimodal, more useful for transit, and also incorporating bike lanes or some other sort of bike accommodation. Unfortunately, the funding did not come through, but we still have it on our minds, and IDOT still has it on theirs.
So it's a demonstration project of sorts?
Kind of. Certainly is a beginning of looking at Main Street in a new way and considering how its function has changed over the years and how it can become a different kind of, you know, thoroughfare for people who use it in town as well as people who come through.
Any idea when that might happen or could happen?
It's really difficult to predict. We are in the midst of like several sea changes in transportation funding and policy making.
From the federal level to the state level to the local level.
All the way. I mean, the most stable is the local level. We know what we want. We've talked about it for years. People have seen things and said, yeah, we want more of that. And this is just another iteration of that process. The problem is this stuff is not cheap, and we have to make sure that we can support the projects we want to do with the appropriate funding. And right now, you know, we just heard from the president a discussion of his proposed $1 trillion infrastructure rebuilding project. But there is very, very little detail, virtually no detail on how that would be funded and how much of it would be private, how much public.
Well, President Trump is an idea guy, not a detail guy. I think that's been established.
True. And when you're talking about $1 trillion, the mind starts to boggle a little bit in teasing out the details. Unfortunately, the one thing we have heard about that is that there's expected to be a de-emphasis on transit funding, which is a not good thing. And I hope that members of Congress who are involved in that will step in.
Well, let's talk about transit. There was a wide disparity when it came to transit's numbers in this response. 40% unfamiliar, generally,
yeah.
And then the other 20% split pretty hard either way on they use it and like it or don't like it or and don't use it. Can you talk a little bit about transit?
I think in terms of those who express what might have been interpreted as a negative opinion, we're really much more in the, I'm not familiar with it, I haven't had occasion to use it, therefore I don't understand it, kind of bin, if you will. And, you know, I think Connect Transit has made some effort in the last couple of years to push against that and say, look, you can use this for other types of, you know, things than the absolute necessity. As far as the people who sort of have no opinion at all, I think that pretty much falls in the same group.
Back to the 85% who drive most of the time.
Yeah, and you know that is a tough number to work against because, and I have to confess, I'm guilty of this too. It is so because it is so easy to get around in a car. The temptation for most of us who do have options, to who have the choice to do that, is to do it because it's faster and easier.
So, looking at those Connect Transit numbers, the survey responses, is there an opportunity there of some sort?
Absolutely.
And what
no
is
question.
That?
I think with people getting accustomed to the big changes that happened last year. And, you know, we're at another transition point for Connect Transit since Andrew Johnson's leaving, and at some point there'll be a replacement, and we'll have a chance to see what ideas whoever that person is brings in. And I know that this will be a challenge for the board as well as all of you look towards how you want to proceed from here on out. That will tell us something about how we can proceed and where the emphasis is going to be. And once the state situation stabilizes, or so we hope, the continuing flow of the state contribution to the operating costs will stabilize. And that will give everyone a better sense of how to proceed. Across the state, there are transit agencies, large and small, in virtual paralysis because they have no idea when the next check's going to arrive. And that's what pays the staff, the drivers, pays maintenance on the buses, the whole nine yards. So without that being settled in some substantive way that everyone feels confident in, we're not going to have a chance to make those decisions.
It's pretty clear that people in the community think the roads need attention. Do they really need attention? Some are good, some are bad, but some people are more critical than others. The roads they travel could be worse than the roads in the rest of the community. Is that really a good gauge of the condition of the road network in the community?
It's not, because everyone has their own bias about, you know, what decisions they want to make for their own path through the community. And yes, there are some locations where the roads are in fairly lousy shape or where there's been some sort of situation arising. We've had water main breaks and that kind of thing that have created a sudden need to make big repairs. You know, sure, there are potholes. It depends on a lot of factors. Overall, and the city of Bloomington in particular has really documented this very carefully, and they have all of it's posted on their website, and you can actually go take a look. And The real constraint, once again, is money. Jim Karch, the Public Works Director, a couple of years ago did a presentation to the City Council about the enormous gap between the projects that they would like to do or need to do to get the road system up to the standard the council wants and how much it would actually cost to do that. And it's a big gap between what you can do and what would be preferable to do to meet that standard.
And we may see more in the next Bloomington budget. They're looking serious at repaving projects in the community. People were pretty clear about keeping the current transportation network in good condition. I want to ask you about that, but also there was a difference in how men and women answered this particular question.
That one has me a little baffled, frankly, although I think it's again, whether or not people feel comfortable with the idea of change that's got a price tag attached to it. In a larger sense, I think some of this flows from the fact that in the Bloomington Comprehensive Plan that we did a couple of years ago, one of the sort of big changes was looking at a much narrower land use area for future development, simply because there's an enormous amount of land available already without going out all over the place. And Normal, we think, is going to head in a similar direction as we finish the Normal plan later this year. So right there, you've got an indication of why it's possible to move forward with the system substantially unchanged and certainly not expanded widely, but it would still be functional. It would still do what it needed to do.
How did men and women answer that question differently?
I'm trying to remember.
There was, for women, it was, I think, the second highest response. And for men, it was the first. And what was the question that, what was the option that women ranked at the top?
Women actually, it was sort of interesting. Women started with improving public transit and special services from public transit. And all the way through, and there are a variety of ways in which you can sort of take this apart and look at the options. But women, especially as they got older, seemed to be more interested in access to kind of collective transportation, public transit, you know, rideshare, that kind of thing.
That's not a surprise.
No, absolutely not.
Empty nesters and older Americans are certainly looking for options for transportation that don't involve them driving the car.
And I also think that there's a component, once again, of a sense of enhanced personal safety. Not only do you not want to drive, even if assuming you had the option, because that, too, becomes more dangerous as time goes on. But the idea of having other people around has something to do with it, too, I think, and that's where we started to see this split. It's much more pronounced after, say, age 50, maybe 60, in the split, although men also become more inclined to favor, again, those group forms of transportation as they get older.
Millennials have been a driving force and will continue to be a force. It's the largest generation alive and making up a big chunk of the McLean County population, more than 50% of the population of the town of Normal. The leading edge of this generation is growing up. They're having families, maybe buying different kinds of housing. What are we learning, maybe not entirely from this survey, about their transportation choices?
There's still a little bit of a divergence, but we're talking about population cohorts that are still relatively broad. And if you talk about, we really have to start talking about millennials in two different groups, the very young adults who are the tail end, and then the, you know, people in their 30s who are now the leading edge. And as you say, are moving into a different phase of life than when a lot of the research was done, unfortunately. So I think we're part of what we're looking for is people who are out looking at this generation again, particularly that older section, and saying, okay, are they doing what they said they would do? Are they doing what we predicted they would do, which is holding on to a more urban neighborhood as a preference, minimizing car ownership, all that stuff? And we don't know yet, because they're just starting to get into the point where that would be something we could measure. And that's something where we rely on the profession to sort of come back to us and say, we've done surveys here and we've done studies there and we've run the numbers and done the statistics and here's what we think is happening.
Could it be that this leading edge is being forced into choices that they don't want to make, that there isn't the housing available for them at the price that they want to have a family of three or four? Or, you know, and then that where they live then would have to influence their transportation choice, because if they live in a house in the Heather Ridge subdivision in Northeast Normal, they have to have a car.
Right. I think that's part of it. We've started to see a real shift in my understanding of the views of the real estate community, in that they're now acknowledging that the kind of housing that we built here, going back decades, really, but certainly there was a boom period in the 90s and the early 2000s, that's not going to work anymore. It's too big. It's too expensive. It's too hard to maintain. And families are smaller than that. They don't need, you know, great massive structures. They don't need roofs that are going to cost $50,000 to fix. That's just nuts. So we're still making that transition, and people are still trying to figure out how to do that in a way that's attractive and that people can understand. And that's very much a moving target at this point. But I think that shift will happen. And as people find that they have wider choices and more affordable choices, and that's something that's very much on the minds of our community planning staff as they look at how this will work over the next 10 years, certainly, and how it works in terms of that preference that we've thought we established with respect to what we call the millennial generation. Giving them options may give them the option to keep up with what they believed when they were 20.
Jennifer Six with the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. She says the outreach on the survey was unprecedented and resulted in over 1,000 responses. The McLean County Long Range Transportation Plan is already in development, using the survey results and input gathered for the Bloomington and Normal Comprehensive Plans, along with other sources. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
GLT comes from Henson Disposal and Recycling, sponsoring a candidate forum with Normal Town Council candidates Tuesday, March 21st at 6 p.m. at University Galleries in Uptown Normal. Details at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Some women are faced with a stark choice: put food on the table or buy feminine hygiene products. There's an answer for Bloomington Normal women who wonder what to do. It's called Project Love the Ladies. Alex and Nancy Cruz with the project will be collecting feminine hygiene products for women in need at the Coffee House Deli in Normal this weekend. In this interview with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Nancy Cruz says they've conducted collections for several years.
We started really kind of back in 2011 when I was doing the newsletter for the Clare House, and we learned about the need in the community. So we kind of did some small collections, and the supplies all went to the Clare House. And then when Tina closed the Clare House, we decided to keep it going so that we could help the women in the community. So really for 4 years, we've been calling ourselves Project Love the Ladies and using Facebook to get the word out.
Why that name?
Why that name? Well, because we love the ladies. You know, I'm kind of passionate about supporting women, and so are my daughters. And so it just kind of fit.
Alex, how big is the need?
It's a very big need. Not a lot of people know that you can't actually buy feminine hygiene products with food stamps. So a lot of shelters and places in the area are always running low. And so when Mom found out about the need, we decided we were going to try to help fill that in any way we could.
How do you distribute them?
Well, once we've collected all of them, then we do three piles, and one pile goes to the Neville House, one pile goes to the Home Sweet Home Mission, and one pile goes to the St. Vincent de Paul Food Pantry.
Who buys and then donates these things? What are they like?
All of our Facebook friends, so thank you to all of those people out there. And then we also have been getting the word out through the Catholic Church bulletins as well. We have a GoFundMe page on our Project Love the Ladies Facebook page. And so not only women are contributing, but men are as well.
How much are you collecting over the years?
Last year, we collected over 6,000 feminine pads and over 3,000 tampons, and then an assortment of other feminine hygiene-type products. At our first collection a couple of weeks ago, we took in over 1,000 pads and other assorted items as well. We've taken in quite a bit of money on our GoFundMe page, which at the end of our collections, we take all of that money, 100% of it minus the GoFundMe fee, and we go and buy feminine hygiene products as cheaply as we can here in town.
How much does that usually turn out to be?
Well, last year, Alex, I want to say, did we have close to $500 that we took with us to Walmart?
And that sounds about right, but yeah. I think we've already more than exceeded that goal just within the first week.
Yes.
What's the buying power? What does $500 get you in feminine hygiene products?
I mean, it got us a couple of carts. That's a fun shopping spree. we ended up with probably two or three. I remember my sisters and Mom and I went and just tried to find what we could get the most items of. And I think we had probably three full carts full of pads, tampons, tried to get a good assortment of things.
When you roll up to the checkout counter with that volume of purchase of one specific area of goods, what's the reaction?
That's interesting because so obviously they know that there's a reason we're purchasing that stuff, and it gives us the opportunity to talk about what we're doing. But it's interesting too. I think there's also that weird stigma about purchasing feminine hygiene products and anything that goes along with with that. So again, it gives us the opportunity to have a conversation with someone that this is a genuine need. This is something that women need biologically, and we're trying to help take care of that.
Sure. Rightly or wrongly, comedy routines have been written about guys in stores, you
exactly.
know, being sent out to make such purchases. Why is this an area that isn't getting recognition or support in the law for inexpensive rates for what is a basic necessity?
We were actually wondering that, why that is something that's written out of what you can purchase with food stamps or help programs like that. We don't actually know. I think it's maybe an uncomfortable conversation for people to have. Not a lot of our lawmakers have to worry about this kind of thing. And so maybe it's just not something that they're comfortable approaching.
Nancy, you had a thought?
If you think about medical research as well, most research is geared toward men and women are kind of forgotten. And I think in a lot of ways, this is just a continuation of that kind of thinking that we're trying to change. You know, it's equally important to pay attention to the needs of women as it is to the needs of men.
Is there any sign of change on the state level?
In August of last year, our state did pass a law that effective January 1st, they were going to remove sales tax on feminine hygiene products, which is definitely a step in the right direction.
How fast do the goods that you distribute to Neville House and the other places you mentioned get used?
So we don't actually get to see that part directly, especially with the Neville House. We have to meet them in a specified location for the privacy and safety of the women there. But from what we understand, when we were working with the Claire House, that's something that's handed out almost immediately, again, because that's something they get very rarely.
But it's a continuous need. Anytime we have donated, if we do it ourselves throughout the year, they mention that this is such a high need that women are always asking for these products and they just are not always available to give to them.
Where can people give if they're so minded?
Well, definitely this weekend at the Coffee House from 12 to 2, we'll be there. If they want to go onto our Project Love the Ladies Facebook page, they can access our GoFundMe link there. There are 3 drop-off boxes around town. One's at Holy Trinity Church, one's at Epiphany, and one's at St. Pat's of Myrna. If they want to contact any of us, we'd be glad to come and pick them up from them. So those would be some ways they could contribute. We do have another drop-off coming up April 1st as well, so there will be another opportunity.
Can you tell us a couple instances of how this has impacted women?
So if you think about it, if you're maybe a mother with children and you are on food stamps or whatever, and you're out there trying to find a job, okay, maybe you get a job interview, but it happens to fall at the wrong time of the month and you don't have supplies. What are you going to do? You're going to cancel that job interview because you're not going to be comfortable or confident to go to that interview. Or what if you're a mother whose daughter has just gotten her first period? It should be a time of excitement and celebration, but you can't send that child to school if she doesn't have feminine hygiene supplies. She's not going to get up in front of her class and give a speech if she doesn't have the correct things she needs to be confident in that situation.
Have you ever run numbers on the number of women in poverty in the community who likely could benefit from this?
We have not.
No. Yeah.
The poverty rate in McLean County is about 15%.
Okay.
About half that's children, so we're at 7%-ish. About half that would be women, mm-hmm. right? Just at a, by guess and by golly kind of thing. So we are at 3.5 to 4% of the population. And 3.5 to 4% of Bloomington Normal is, we're what, 120,000 metro area? So 4,000 people.
Well, I'm a firm believer in, you know, I can't help everybody in the world, but I can help somebody, and I can start in my own community. And so that's really one of the reasons I wanted to start something like this, was at least we're helping somebody, and we're getting it started, and we're providing awareness, and maybe what we do, somebody else hears about, and they start it in their community, and it spreads, and it helps a lot more people just because we started here in Bloomington Normal.
Nancy and Alex Cruz are with Project Love the Ladies. They spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. Project Love the Ladies is collecting feminine hygiene products at the Coffee House in Normal, Saturday from noon until 2. You're listening to Sound Ideas. During Sound Ideas, it's an edition of What's on Your Turntable featuring the band Deaf Heaven coming to the Castle Theater on Saturday. John Norton talks with Trevor Basham at Waiting Room Records coming up during Sound Ideas here on GLT. As the Trump administration's anti-immigration policies spark protests and heighten tensions across the country, Bloomington's Community Players is mounting a classic Broadway musical that distills the age-old conflict between more settled ethnic Americans and newer immigrant arrivals. West Side Story examines the rivalry between Puerto Ricans and older European ethnic groups in New York. Though set in the 1950s, the show mirrors the ongoing struggles of immigrants today. GLT's Judy Valente has more.
Perhaps the most familiar opening notes of any American musical come from composer Leonard Bernstein's classic score for West Side Story. It premiered on Broadway in the 1950s and followed the rivalry between ethnic New York teens and young immigrant Puerto Ricans. The show and its opening lines, "Hey, brown boy, this is our street. Swim back to where you came from," demonstrate perhaps just how little we've progressed as a nation. Director Alan Wilson says audiences are sure to see the parallels between the struggles of New York's Puerto Rican community in the 50s and the debate raging today over immigrants.
I think the story is so timeless. It opened on Broadway in 1957. And, you know, at that time after the war and so much immigration was going on. And in this story, I find it interesting because as the Puerto Ricans are talking about the Americans, they don't call them Americans. They talk about them being from Poland or being from Italy. And I think it brings out the fact that we're all immigrants in one way or another. And I think that story is very timely, that the tension and also how we can draw together. It's a classic Romeo and Juliet story, the warring families. And, you know, love conquers all. And this is a story that really brings that out.
Are you doing anything new with the production to refresh it a bit? Because it is so iconic.
You know, I think the biggest thing we've done, you know, at the suggestion of our music director, we've added children in the show to sing the song Somewhere. We have two groups of children that are doing alternate performances. And I think it's very poignant when these children sing the song Somewhere and the longing about finding a place where the differences don't make any, you know, don't matter, where it doesn't matter your background or where you come from. It's just about being people. And I think hearing children sing that song is a twist that's very poignant and very enjoyable. And we have some great kids in the cast.
Has that ever been done in another production?
You know, not any production that I've been a part of. But I think, you know, I just think it's a great idea that the hope of the children in our world is that someday there will be that place for them.
The score, as you mentioned, is very operatic. In fact, Natalie Wood, who played the role of Maria in the movie, didn't sing.
Right.
Marnie Nixon, I believe, had to be brought in to sing.
Yes.
Had a lovely operatic voice. How have the actors been able to cope with that strenuous score?
You know, we have some extremely talented people. Teresa Williams plays Maria, and Brady Hughes plays Tony. They're both brand new to our theater, but they have incredible voices, incredible control. So I was really lucky to find a cast to do what needed to be done. Our Anita and our Bernardo, such different roles, such different vocal talents, and yet so important to in the difference between those lead roles. So I've been very lucky with having people who can handle that challenging music. And you know, we've had a great choreographer in Billy Blue, and you know, the dancing is also iconic.
Jerome Robbins.
Jerome Robbins, you know, choreographed that and directed that originally on Broadway. And I think, you know, the thing is, in a community theater, we are not trained dancers. We are not trained singers. But we come in and, you know, we do a great job. And I think that, you know, says something about our community and the fact that they come out and do these things, even though they're a challenge. And they work so hard at getting it just the way they want it.
What about the casting? We don't have a huge Hispanic community here in Bloomington Normal, so how do you cast the roles of the sharks?
You know, we always try to cast as ethnically close as we can, but when we can't, we take the talent that we have and cast them the best we can. You know, the girl, Teresa Williams, who's playing our Maria, is actually Turkish, And I think that's kind of interesting that we can blur those lines. You know, in the movie, I know Rita Moreno at one point said one of the things she didn't like about the movie that they were in.
Rita Moreno, who played
Anita. Yes. And, you know, she said the fact that they darkened all of their skin. They made them all the same color. And, you know, she said there's as many varieties in Puerto Rico in skin color as there is in America. And so, you know, we have African-Americans on both sides as Jets and as Sharks. And, you know, so we try to be as ethnically sensitive as we can and yet try to cast colorblind as well. You know, we don't want to hold people back because they're, quote, not the right ethnicity, and because if they really have the talent for the role, that's our main concern.
I realize that you picked these shows well in advance, but did you look at West Side Story because this whole discourse on immigrants, the seeming pushback to anyone who's not been born here in America, that was already brewing a year ago?
It absolutely was when the presidential race became much more heated. We could see this coming up, and you know, we try to pick things that, you know, our contemporary and classic at the same time. And this was definitely a show that fit that bill. And we were very pleased. And picking a show at this level, at this difficulty level, is always a question a year ahead of time. But again, we were lucky to come out. Both of our leads, this is their first time at Community Players. So we were lucky to get them.
I always like to ask the director if there is a moment that he really wants the audience to be paying attention in this particular production.
You know, I think the very last scene is iconic. After Tony is killed, I hope that's not a spoiler for people, but after Tony is killed at the end, Maria brings both sides together to help her take Tony off stage away. And I think that commonality at the end, that they've all lost something in that, you know, is important for people to see, and very poignant, I think, that, you know, hopefully we can solve these problems before it gets to that point. And I think that's the takeaway I hope our audiences get, that these problems are solvable.
Hold my hand and we're halfway down. Chevame para no Adoro, Anton.
Ellen Wilson is the director of West Side Story. It is on stage at the Community Players in Bloomington. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Judy Valente.
West Side Story is on stage at Bloomington's Community Players this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and March 24th through the 26th. The music you heard in our report was from the 2009 cast recording of the Broadway revival of West Side Story. From that cast recording, you're listening to Matt Cavanaugh singing Maria.
Maria, and suddenly that name will never be the same to me. Maria, I've just kissed a girl named Maria, and suddenly I found how wonderful a sound can be. Maria.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on GLT.
On the next Radio Lab. Tick. It's like an arms race.
It's no holds barred.
There are legions dying all the time.
Outnumber the enemy enough, and you can wipe out anything.
You can actually see this carnage from space.
Yeah, tic-tac-toe.
We had absolutely no guilt at all, like none.
Epic battles on the next Radiolab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Off and Running, a company that values the health and happiness of our local community by supporting runners and running events. Off and Running says walk, jog, or run through their doors and learn more information about the quality services and products they offer at offandrunning.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Occasionally, GLT's John Norton stops by local record stores to hear what's playing on the turntable while customers browse the bins. With Deaf Heaven playing the Castle Theater this Saturday night, it's no surprise Trevor Basham at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal has been featuring a heavy dose of Deaf Heaven on the store's turntable.
So with Deaf Heaven coming to the Castle Theater real soon, it's been about 3 years, I think, that Jared was the one who reviewed the Sunbather album about 3 or 4 years ago. So we thought, even though this new album called
New Bermuda
is it's a couple of years old, but we got to catch up with it. So okay, we're playing what, the opening track right now to New Bermuda?
What's the opening track? It's called Brought to the Water.
Okay, let me play it for a minute here. All right, then, if you don't mind, could you put on now the opening track to Sunbather?
Yeah, the opening track to Sunbather is called Dream House.
Okay, let's play that for a couple of minutes, or a couple of seconds here. For a guy who's not really drawn to this kind of music, I fell in love with this album, the Sunbather album from 3 years ago, and especially this opening track, even though it's loud, and I can't understand the lyrics, there's some kind of symphonic quality to it that really drew me in. It was almost hypnotic for me.
Yeah, Sunbather was a great album. It came out in 2013, and it was one of the top-rated albums of the year on multiple lists across the board. I mean, it was definitely one of my favorites. It was amazing. It was refreshing to have this cool new sound that I haven't really heard, this mashup of, like, black metal and shoegaze.
Well, it had the really interesting ability... I'm really angry. This song called me down.
Definitely, yeah. It's like, it's weird because, yeah, it's all these blasts of like furious and ferocious guitars just churning out these distorted riffs of just walls of sound. And
well, I played it for my then 16-year-old. He looked at me kind of funny. Like,
yeah,
what is
Dad, what are you listening to? Yeah.
All right, well, let's put the opening track back on to New Bermuda. There's somewhat of a similar intensity to it, but it's a lot darker.
Yeah, definitely. You can tell immediately with New Bermuda that it's a different kind of album. It's definitely darker. It's definitely a lot more serious and grounded in reality. It has these thrashier moments to it, these more almost speed metal type parts, you know, that are reminiscent of like Slayer riffs that I think I can hear on there. And
well, when I walked in the store this morning, you were telling me though, Def Heaven isn't black metal.
No,
but they kind of get shoehorned into that, though.
Yeah, they get thrown into like the whole black metal genre, which they don't disagree with entirely. I mean, they obviously agree that they have obvious influences from that genre, you know, like Dark Throne or Burzum and things like that.
For our listeners who don't understand even what black metal is, and that all sounds the same, what can you in a short sense?
Yeah, black metal is an offshoot of one of the various subgenres of metal that there are, but it was started in the 90s in Norway with like bands like, you know, Dark Throne and Burzum, who have like these extremely distorted, fast and thrashy riffs with these indiscernible kind of lyrics that are recorded intentionally with the worst technology and worst quality possible because they believe that adds to their aesthetic.
And what's the difference between that and what we're listening to right now with Def Heaven?
Well, Def Heaven, they definitely, you hear those parts, but it's cleanly produced. It sounds fantastic. It's crisp, but you know, you get these tones of obvious shoegaze references, you know, of like Slow Dive or My Bloody Valentine. You know, these beautiful washy kind of sounds and guitar riffs that bleed together with the faster, you know, more interlude parts that are, you know, just destroying your ears with these crushing riffs. They're blasting you in these vocals that are just so distorted and fuzzed out you can't even discern them. But yeah, it's weird. It mixes so many different genres and like feelings that are almost contradictory. But yeah, it gives you almost the sense of like hopefulness and happiness through this barrage of intense sound.
Well, the walls are shaking here at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal, even drowning out the trains going by occasionally. So what Def Heaven is what we're listening to. The last album, Sunbather, had some quieter moments. Is there a quieter moment or two on this album as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, New Bermuda is definitely, like I said, heavier and a little bit darker in its content. But there are definitely those quiet interlude parts, you know, on the third track of the album.
What's this called now?
The third track is called Baby Blue.
All right.
Yeah, probably one of the, I don't want to say slower songs, but more gentle songs, I suppose, on the album. And it definitely has a little bit of change of pace.
What are they saying in Baby Blue? Can we, do we have to go to the liner notes probably?
Yeah, flip open the liner notes here because, you know,
it's really hard to decipher what they're
saying. I couldn't tell
you,
you know, if I just listened to it off the top of my head.
Even you, and you're a huge fan.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, even the biggest diehard fans, you know, they got to look at the liner notes every once in a while. It's a really beautiful packaging. And on Baby Blue, you know, they have lyrics like, to not be buried in native clay and preserved for cynicism. I feel the gravel beneath my knees to wake in a home. It's like almost cut-up types of lyrics where you can tell the sense of what he's trying to get at, but the lyrics themselves, they act more of like a landscape or visual painting of what he wants the song to feel or look like, I suppose, you know. You know, on different parts of the album, he has lyrics like a multiverse of fuchsia and violet surrender to blackness now. Which, you know, I think kind of sums up the feeling of the album. You know, it's somebody that was obviously so bright and shiny and, like, hopeful and almost adolescent in its content. And New Bermuda now, it's like they have that, but it's this blackness is kind of closing in on it almost, you know.
Baby, 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 baby.
reading some of the interviews with the lead singer, George Clark, you know, he talks about how the difference between Sunbather and New Bermuda is like that New Bermuda, he feels, is more grounded in reality. You know, it's all about the hopes that he had about being successful as a musician and then gaining all that through Sunbather, essentially, and now having this family and, you know, the job and the car and house payments, you know, he kind of gets thrown into like this kind of mundane,
careful what you
almost,
ask for.
Suburban, you know, lifestyle, which, you know,
really cuts against what they're trying to represent almost, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah.
How do you maintain your edge when...
Exactly, when you've achieved success, you know, it's some people can't deal with it, you know. Some musicians, it kills them. And hopefully this isn't the case with Def Heaven. I hope they stay around for quite a while and make a couple more albums.
Trevor Basham at Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal. We're reviewing the most recent release from Def Heaven. Thank you so much for your time here, Trevor, and I know you're going to enjoy the show, right?
Oh, yeah, man. I hope you're going to be there. You know, bring your earplugs if you need to, but it's going to be great.
Trevor Basham of Waiting Room Records in Uptown Normal talking about Def Heaven's most recent release, New Bermuda. You're listening to The Gift from the band. Def Heaven plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington Saturday night. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories heard today, thanks to John Norton, Judy Valente, and Charlie Schlenker, at our website, WGLT.org. Also thanks to Jennifer Six with the McLean County Regional Planning Commission. We want your opinions about what you hear on Sound Ideas. Post at Facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet about the show. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at Mike McCurdy. We're all at WGLT.org. This is GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.